Good morning, everyone. Thank you to Nancy for organizing. So my name is Jonathan Ziering. I'm with the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. We're a study hall and we teach classes around the community. So I'm very happy to be doing this series before Pesach as we approach the Seder. So the plan for the next 3 weeks is as follows. What we have here, this is not all the sources for today. It's for this week, definitely next week, and possibly all three. I may have to add material for the third. It's to try to understand a few things. Our end goal is to understand and maybe add different customs to the Seder that will help enrich our Pesach experience. But what I want to do, and the first session, we're not going to actually discuss the Seder directly. What I want to do is I want to understand why it is that customs are important in Judaism at all. In general, when we talk about Jewish practice, so that includes law, but it also includes custom and the line between custom and law, and what does it even mean to have a custom? To what extent are customs like laws? Are they different? How do we develop customs, generate customs, generate new customs? All those questions, I think, are worthy of thinking about in general, and especially as we approach Pesach, as we approach Passover, where customs of all sorts play such a deep role in our experience, I think it will deepen our experience of the Seder if we first try to understand the nature of custom and the value of custom in general. So what I want to do the first week is really understand the value of custom, and then as you see, where it starts session two, which is three pages in, some of these things I'm not going to read all inside. Some of it I put reading material. You can continue. Some of it we will read all of it inside. Some of it we'll summarize. I put five customs that I want to analyze. There was a question in advance of whether we will be doing things for children at the Seder. Of the five customs I've chosen to analyze so far, four are for children and one is not. So the answer to that question is yes. The Seder is about teaching children, so many of the customs really do develop with children in mind. At the end, we'll talk about a little bit more about that. One thing that I discussed with Nancy, and this is a possibility, it's up to you, is starting not this week, but the second and third session, to open, let's say, the last 10 or 15 minutes of the session for people to present, let's say, 5 minutes each on a custom that you have from your Seder that you would like to share with the group that perhaps other people would learn from, if there are people who are willing to present. So think about it. At the end, if there's anyone who's interested in doing that, we'll try to plan for next week and the week after that to bracket off 10, 15 minutes in the end of each session to do that. So now let's jump in. So what is the value of custom in Judaism? So this question is a very, very old question. It's not just a question within classic, let's say, rabbinic Judaism. I put here a source from Philo. Now, Philo was a Jew, but living in 25 before the Common Era to 50 of the Common Era in Alexandria. But he's a Jewish Greek philosopher. That's what he is. So he's trying to understand the value of custom from a perspective it will speak not just to Jews, but to the whole world, to Greeks. So in source 1, this is from Philo in the Special Laws 4, he writes as follows. The verse says, "Thou shalt not move thy neighbor's landmarks which the former men have set up." There's a law that when you enter the land of Israel, they would put up border markers between the different plots of land that were given out, and you couldn't encroach on someone else's land. You couldn't steal other people's land. But there is a homiletic that was derived from this verse, both by the rabbis, but also from Philo, actually earlier than we have it in the rabbinic material. That homiletic, inspiring sermons that don't necessarily relate to the actual meaning of the verse. Right. So in addition to the actual meaning of the verse, there was this, people used this to talk about the value of custom. And he writes as follows, "This injunction is given, as it seems, not only with respect to inheritances and to the boundaries of the land, but also as a guard to ancient customs. For customs are unwritten laws, being the doctrines of men of old, not engraved on pillars or written on paper, which may be eaten by moths, but impressed in the souls of those living under the same constitution. For the children ought to inherit from the father of their being the national customs in which they have been brought up, and in which they have lived from the cradle, and not to despise them merely because they are handed down without being written. For the man who obeys the written laws is not justly entitled to any praise, inasmuch as he is influenced by compulsion and the fear of punishment. But he who abides by the unwritten laws is worthy of praise, as exhibiting a spontaneous and unconstrained virtue. So Philo argues beautifully that custom, the difference between custom and law, law traditionally is that which is enforceable, is that which is written down in the rule books, which is that which is issued by the legislature, that which is formalized. Custom is that which gives meaning to the fabric of our lives, right? It's, you know, his language is beautiful here, right? It's not written on paper that can be eaten by moths. It's that which lives within us. And he says, and this is where he moves back to the verse, just like parents bequeath land to their children, inheritance to their children, everyone has, whether it be the house they inherited from their parents, or that dress, or that book, or that heirloom, they also impart customs, an ethical will, a tradition. And he said that which he calls the spontaneous and unconstrained virtue, that which is not really law, is really what gives the, you know, fills in the meaning to our life. Right? We all know this, that law sort of, you know, law, rules, protocols can sort of outline the skeleton of our lives. But it's those things that can't quite be quantified that we experience that give it the body, that give it the life, that breathe life into that body. So that's what custom is about. It's about breathing life beyond the basic protocol set up in the skeleton of law. But when we approach the question of, well, what is the value of a custom, we need to not just ask in general, you know, why is custom valuable? We have to ask, well, what is a custom? What does it mean to have a custom? And there are many different types of customs. So in 2 and 3, I give you a list. In 2, when we talk about customs, we have customs from different sources. You know, you can look at the list or you can say, right, where do we get customs from? Right? Even that, looking at the list, right? Where do we inherit customs from?
From our parents.
From our parents, so family, right? Our family gives us our traditions.
Different nations.
Right? Our nations, and that we can divide into two. Nations both geographic. Right? We live in Canada, and there are certain traditions. Right? You know, I moved to Canada in August, and you know, I found out quickly that as it came to what we have is Veterans Day. It's Veterans Day here. They have the red, the poppy, right? Which we don't do in the States, right? But geographic customs. There are ethnic customs, not the nation you currently live in, but the nation you once came from. Right? Italians have Italian customs, and Greeks have Greek customs. And you know, my big fat Greek wedding is a comical sort of iteration of Greek culture. Yeah.
From our peers, from our elders.
Our peers, right? We have social group customs.
From our ancestors,
right? We have national customs. So that's what I put here.
Wait a minute, there's one more comment.
Yeah.
In our contemporary life, we have a lot of customs added to the Seder table from ideological movements.
Mm. Like, right, meaning our...
Like what you put on the table because of either egalitarian or environmental, any ideology of the day.
Right, so we have... Right, I actually didn't put that here, but yeah, meaning...
They're not national, but they're like...
Right, they're
philosophical in a way.
Yeah, so that's actually an interesting point. I probably should have put it. One of my teachers, Ravaran Lichtenstein, used to point out that in the modern world, this is a new phenomenon. He said the role of ethnicity, like local ethnic customs, has been replaced by ideology. Because he said, right, it used to be, let's say you lived in Germany, right? So the German milieu had a certain ideology and a certain way of life, and you had customs from that. But now we live in a global world, so you choose to be, let's say, a Yek, right, part of the German community. You choose to be. So he argued, I think, compellingly, that the role of ideological customs has replaced in many ways the strength or bolstered the strength of what used to be local customs. Right? It used to be you would move into a community of people of, let's say, like ideology, or you happen to live together and you had a certain social milieu. Now we don't. We identify, you know, with our, whatever it might be, our LinkedIn group, right? That's our chosen peer group based on by an ideology and profession. So I think that's a very good point. So in two, I just list that in halachic discourse, we have these four categories: minhag ha-makom, the custom of the place; minhag ha-avot, family custom; minhag ha-eida, which for lack of a better translation, lack of ethnic group, the custom of the ethnic group, but by that I mean Ashkenazim, right, people of European descent; Svardim, right, the Yemenites have their own customs. I don't know if ethnic's the right word, but that's what I'm referring to. And then Minhag Yisrael, the custom of the Jewish people, national customs. In three, I note that there's another distinction we have to make, and that is the what types of customs are we talking about? So there are non-halachic customs. There are things where no one claims they're obligatory. It's just what we do. Then there's mistaken customs. We should remember that that is a category. That is possible. Sometimes there are customs that are just wrong. They're not. They might be nice, but sometimes things can actually be wrong. There's also, in halacha, the rabbis discuss customs to rule in accordance with particular positions. Right? Sometimes you can have a custom to accept a legal position. Right? There's a dispute of how you should rule, and certain communities accepted a legal position, and they are accustomed to accept the legal position. That's somewhere in between custom and law, because there's a dispute about the law, and your custom is to accept one of those positions, which is a middle position. And then the fourth thing here is to accept religiously valuable activities, things that are not technically obligatory, but we can describe in formal legal terms. Right, so sometimes you'll have in legal discussion, this is not obligatory, but one who fears God will accept it. And then a group of people will accept that custom. So it's not non-legal, but it's also not fully legal. It's somewhere in between. You're taking something which is formulated as going beyond the letter of the law and accepting to obligate yourself in it. So that's a type of custom which will might have a stronger pull to it than some of the other customs. So that's just a basic overview of the type of customs that we'll sometimes see. Okay, so what I want to do here is try to understand the basis and value and legal import, as it were, of each of these types of customs. So, starting in source 4, the most traditionally discussed source of custom was what we call minhag ha-makom, the custom of the place. And this has to do with historical, I don't know, historical quirks. We are the historical quirk. Had to do with the way history was lived until very recently, which was travel was hard. So people basically grew up in their whatever, their shtetl, their city, their town, and maybe they traveled and maybe they didn't. But if you think of history, it used to be that the travelogue of the traveler sold as a bestseller because it was only, you know, Lewis and Clark and Marco Polo and whatever who could go across the whole world and see the amazing things happening in the Middle East or wherever it might be. I'm in the middle of Michael Oren's book on the history of America's involvement in the Middle East. Right? People, the bestseller was a history, was a travelogue, a bestseller in the mid-18th century. It was a travelogue of going to the Middle East and a 1001 tale, Arabian Night, Tales of Arabian Nights, whatever it is. Because for people, that was the same thing. You never went to the Middle East, so fantasy and reality, it was all equally exotic. People didn't travel. So your customs, what you knew, was what you grew up with in your city. Sometimes you moved, but if you moved, you probably didn't move back. Right? You moved. Right, people traveled. Traveling was a big deal. If you decided that you couldn't make it here financially and you moved to a new city, a new country, there was persecution, you moved to the new city, new country, and you stayed there. So customs traditionally were developed based on locale. And therefore, in halachic literature, the classic type of custom is customs of the locale, of the place. And this is seen in source 4. The Talmud in Psachim says as follows: one who goes from a place It's discussing there was a custom to not work the day before Passover, to not do work, but it wasn't obligatory, it was just a custom. So one who goes from a place where the custom is to work on Erev Pesach, on the day before Passover, to a place where they don't work, or from a place where they don't work to a place where they do work, we give him the stringencies of the place he left and the stringencies of the place he went to. So let's say someone lived in a place where they didn't work the day before Passover. He's not moving to a new city. He is the unique traveling businessman. He's planning on coming home. And now he's going to a place where they do work on the day before Passover. So can he work on the day before Passover? So the Mishnah here, the Talmud quotes it, says he cannot. Until he chooses to leave place one, he has to follow all his own customs from his place. But let's say it's the other way around. He works on the day before Passover, but he comes to a city where no one works the day before Passover. So he also can't work because no one else is working. He can't be the sore thumb in the group. He can't be, as the Talmud will explain in other places, standing among the sitters or sitting among the standing. Right? He can't stand out. So he does whatever is stricter. So if he normally doesn't work, he doesn't work. If they don't work, but he does, he also can't work. But the category we're talking about is place. Yes?
Second, you said, it's not here, but you presumably know the sugya, that the man was intending to return home. And so...
I'm assuming that. Wait, it's not that obvious, but I'm assuming that for the moment. Yes.
So if that's true, when he's in the new place, it makes sense for him to have to do both because he's going to go back home. And he has to not forget his own practice and he has to not offend the people there. But what if... he's going to stay in the new place.
Right. So.
And is this, does this matter? What?
Correct. So here I'm taking a side. The standard halachic line of thought, which is taken by the commentaries on Shulchan Aruch, by the Magen Avram, by the Shach, and by others, is that this line refers specifically to the person who's going back. If he's not going back, he just becomes a member of the new city.
So he can abandon...
and he abandons his own stringencies.
Exactly. And takes on where he's living now.
Correct. Okay. So the way this is classically presented is, as you just said, is that if someone is going to move towns, then he takes on the new customs, both the stringencies and the leniencies. If he is in between, or he's visiting, but he's still a member of the other city, so then he has to be doubly strict.
So that's
an interesting question because that's on that line between custom and law. It's law which is formulated by the Talmud as a custom, and that's why there is a dispute amongst modern authorities whether a Canadian in Israel has to keep the eighth day or not. Some say they do because it's law. Some say they don't because it's a custom formulated into law, or some say it's the custom, but it's not the custom of the place, it's the custom of those traveling. So that is part of a complicated discussion on the border between law and custom, yes.
So if Israeli comes here and lives
if he moves here,
he doesn't want to do two seders, he only wants to do one seder.
So if he's visiting,
no,
it's a
if
dispute.
He's
if he moves here, he has to keep two. If he moves here, he has to keep two. Okay, so that is... Now, Nancy, the exception to this is Maimonides. Maimonides does not believe what I just said. Maimonides thinks that you always keep the customs, that even if you move, you have to keep both stringencies forever. And people try to figure out why, but that's not... We're going to leave that aside because that is not the standard position. We're going to assume that this is a case where he has not moved into the new city. So what we know off the bat is there's something called a minhag ha-makom, a custom of a place. And that makes sense, right? Especially in the ancient world, this makes a lot of sense. By ancient, I mean anything pre-19th century, let's say. Definitely pre-18th century, right? You know, trains and cars were developed, so fine. Planes was already, is a different world, right? You don't find in early literature, what if I'm in Israel for the first day of Pesach and I'm back in, the States for the third day of Pesach, because that was impossible. But let's at least say in the last few hundred years, this is possible that you travel more, but it wasn't traditionally. So we know that there's something called a minhag ha-makom, the custom of a place. And in halacha, that is the classic case of custom. You are bound to the customs of your place. Okay. But we don't live in the time of the Talmud. And now things are much more complicated because we do travel a lot. And people come from all different types of places that hold all types of different customs. And when we classically think of custom, right, when you ask a person who hasn't really looked into the question, but just intuitively, what is the classic type of custom you think about? You think of family customs. Because we don't think about customs of our place. Even in Toronto, like what is the custom of Toronto on anything? I don't know. We barely have a custom of our... Barely. We don't have a custom usually even within our shul. Maybe within our shul we have a custom, but probably not. Right? Some people have been in Toronto for 5 generations. Some people came 5 years ago and have their own traditions. Right? There aren't traditions of all of Toronto. Maybe you have within one shul, maybe you don't. We tend to think of, this is my father's tradition, my family's tradition. My father did this, my mother did this, my brother does this, my uncle did that. So that's how we think of custom. And traditionally, people did keep the customs of their fathers. But why? But why?
Do not forsake the teaching of your mother.
Well, don't worry. We're gonna come back to that. Trust me, that is my second to last source. We're gonna come back to that. Don't worry. But traditionally, people kept the customs of their parents. But there's a caveat here. Why did the average person keep the custom of his family in the 15th century?
That's all they knew.
Why was that all they knew?
They didn't travel.
They didn't travel. Meaning, the custom of their parents were equivalent to the custom of.
The place,
right? So
they were all the same because they were all the same types of people.
Exactly. Exactly.
There was no internet. There was no mixing. There was no sparring.
Exactly.
Right. They wore the same clothes.
Exactly. So
and books were very expensive.
And books were expensive.
So in effect, the people were the Torah.
Correct. So and we'll come back. Well, we'll come back to this towards the end as well. You don't find much discussion in early sources about family customs. Now, that could be for one of two reasons. That could be because family customs are not binding, or it could be that family customs are binding, but it was very rare for someone to have a family custom which wasn't also the custom of his place, and we know that the customs of the place are binding. So, it's a very modern question that people ask, okay, well, what happens if I can divorce the two? Right? What if I have a family custom, which is not the custom of the place? Is that binding or not? That's a very modern question. So what's the answer to that question? Well, it's unclear, but let's continue in this source. So we have, after the ellipsis here, the Talmud continues and says as follows. The children of Bashan, this was a place, were accustomed not to go from Tyre to Sidon on the eve of the Sabbath. They had a custom, they didn't travel on Friday. Their children went to Rabbi Yochanan and said to him, for our fathers this was possible. Our fathers could take off every Friday and didn't have to travel. For us it's impossible. So can we shirk this custom? Can we travel on Friday? He said to them, your fathers have already taken upon themselves, as it is said, hear, my son, the instruction of thy father, and forsake not the teaching of thy mother, so you cannot. Mm-hmm. Now, does this passage tell us that family customs are binding or not? Well, it's not clear, because the Hebrew of this is more ambiguous than the English. The word isn't actually children of Bashan, it's the Hebrew, b'nei Bashan. B'nei Bashan means one of two things. It either means the children of Bashan, or it means... Well, either means the children or family, or it means the people of the city. Right? B'nei Ha'ir, the children of the city, means the residents. Right? B'nei is ambiguous. So, this word Bashan, well, what is Bashan? Is Bashan the equivalent of Cohen? Right? Is it a last name? Or is Bashan a place? Which is it? Well, if it's a place, so then all this tells us is that Minna, customs of the place are binding, but it tells us nothing about family. If Bashan was a family name, was, you know, the children of this person named Bashan, then we would have precedent already in the Talmud that family customs are also binding just like local customs. This is a dispute. Some people really think that Beishan was a family. So if you look in 5, for example, Reb Chaim ben Attar, living in 1696 to 1743 Morocco, writes, B'nai Beishan are really members of the Beishan family. Literally, B'nai Beishan means the family. So Reb Chaim ben Attar thinks that family customs are binding just like local customs. However, the majority of halachic authorities thought this was not the case, that Beishan was a place, and they prove it from source 6. 6 has the following. There are the laws of not mixing milk and meat. In addition to not cooking milk and meat together, which is the biblical law, customs developed as early as the Talmud to wait a certain number of hours between meat and milk. The standard customs now, 6 hours, 3 hours, 1 hour, whatever the custom might be. But this is going back since the time of the Talmud, there were different customs. Mar Ukba said, this is source 6, in this matter I am as vinegar is to wine compared to my father. It's a nice parable, right? My father was wine, I'm his child, I'm also a wine product, but I'm vinegar, I'm not as good as my father. For if my father would eat meat now, he would not eat cheese until this hour tomorrow, meaning 24 hours from now. I do not eat cheese in the same meal, but I do eat it in my next meal. So my father used to wait 24 hours, and I wait till the next meal, whatever the next meal means, until the next meal. But what do you see from this? Mar Ukba's father had a custom. Did he keep it? No. So from this, in 7 and 8, Rabbi Yair Bachrach in 17th century Germany writes, the verse, "Hear my son, the rebuke of your father," is just an asmachta, meaning it's not a real derivation from the verse. It's just a... We use the verse to hang the law on as a mnemonic to make us remember the law, but it's not a real biblical source. Okay, and then he said we should note that it's only a public acceptance in a community that was established together, and that which Rabbi Yochanan was stringent on B'nai Beishan was because of the place. Said B'nai Beishan was a place. Family minhagim, family customs are not binding. And the Pisrei Tshuva in source A, Avram Eisenstadt, living in 19th century Russia, says the same thing. A son is not obligated to follow the customs of his father besides for those that the son was accustomed to after he became an adult. He says, look, you don't have to keep your father's customs. If you chose to follow what your father did after you were an adult, not living in his house, and you chose to follow his customs, so you're bound by them, not because they were your father's customs, but because they are your customs. Once you've accepted it, fine. But this is not the case if the son did not start following the good custom of his father. You're not bound to accept everything your father did. However, others...
If we were, then Abraham would have to follow the custom of his father.
Right, so there are obviously exceptions to this rule, and part of it is we're going to have to understand what custom is, and that's why I have 2 and 3, right? 2 is where do customs come from, and 3 is what type of customs are we talking about. Now, I think the majority of rabbinic decisors in the 20th century actually side with the positions of Rabbi Bachrach and Rabbi Eisenstadt here and say that family customs, while nice and meaningful, are not formally binding the way local customs once were. There are exceptions to that. For example, in 9, Rabbi Yosef Shalmel Yashiv, who died just a few years ago in Israeli authority, he rules like Rabbi Attar, and he says that an individual who accepted upon himself a good custom, this obligates his children, as it says, do not abandon the teachings of your mother. Now, he still has to deal with the fact that in source 6, we see that sometimes children did not accept their father's customs. So he provides an explanation. He says, however, an individual does not have to choose all the customs of his father and act like it. Only those things that his father accepted also on his children after him. He says it depends. Sometimes you do things, but don't expect your children to do them as well. You have something you like doing, so that your children don't have to do. But something you accepted for your whole family, you do have to do, that your children do have to follow. So we just look back at this. What we have so far is that from the Talmud, local customs are binding. Family customs, we don't know. We have a clear piece of evidence that at least some family customs are not binding, such as in the case of the meat and milk waiting in number 6. And we have an ambiguous phrase in 4 about these children of Bashan. So some authorities just take the position that, in fact, while family customs may be meaningful, they're not actually binding. And if you choose to follow a different custom than your parents, you are allowed to. And that's the position of Rabbi Bachrach, Rabbi Eisenstadt, in modern, in 20th century and 21st century authorities, that's the position of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Rabbi Vadya Yosef, and others. There are others who think that no, family customs are binding. But, as we saw in 9, they qualify that. Only family customs, which were actually accepted as family customs, not things that your father happened to do. Things your parents accepted as family customs, so those will be binding. Okay. Now, in 10, the father of Maimonides, he has a composition on prayer, and this comes back to your question. Sorry, what's your name?
Diane.
So he says, well, the source for this entire discussion is this verse, do not abandon the teachings of your mother. So he said, okay, well, what does that mean? So, mother can either mean mother, but mother also means something else. Right? Mother, think of, what does it mean? Right? If you think in sort of, 19th century nationalism terms, mother is? The land, exactly, the nation. So that's actually how he takes it. He takes it, those who developed the custom showed alacrity and effort, and you should not deride the custom of the nation. The prophet said, do not abandon the teachings of your mother. Do not leave the religion of your nation. He says, mother here doesn't mean your parents. It means Mother Israel, right? Mother Canada. I don't know, do people say Mother Canada? I assume they must. Right? No one says Mother Canada? I'd never heard it, but that's because I grew up in the States. So, okay. Mother Israel. Mother Russia. Mother Russia. Okay. Mother Russia.
But not mother, mother.
But not mother, mother, not father, father. That's true. We're gonna come back to that. Don't worry. We're gonna come back to it. We're gonna have some beautiful stuff on that in just a few minutes. Okay. So he actually says that this notion of custom actually derives from, if you remember our list here at 2, category 4. He says, actually, what's the most basic type of custom? Not your local custom. It's an even more basic custom, which is national customs. I'll give a nice example. The Seder. Okay? Right? The Seder is a national Jewish custom, which 95% of it is, well, I don't know, 75% of it is not legal. Right? It's a custom. The Haggadah does not appear in the Talmud. It is a work written after that. And it compiled as we know it was hundreds of years after that. And yet the entire Jewish nation of all stripes from the entire range of religiosity has some sort of Seder. This is a national custom. And he actually thinks... What?
When did it start? When was the first Seder?
The second. Well, first Seder.
Well, look, there were there were some versions of the Seder going back, yes, since since we left Egypt. Because having the Karban Pesach, the Passover offering, eating matzah and things like that, and telling the story, the basics of the Seder is as old as the Exodus. The Seder, as we know it, we're not really sure, 1,500 years old maybe, who knows? Old. And in the Talmud, we know that they're having some sort of Seder, they're telling some type of story. Our Seders, we know them, have developed. But if ever there was a national custom, it would be the Seder. Yeah, Nancy.
I know I have some historical knowledge on this, Miriam. A lot of the stuff that, I mean, there's a great book called the Polychrome Haggadah, which shows you in different colors of print when the texts came in. Some are biblical, some are Talmudic, yeah. Some are post-Talmudic. Mm. But there's also some historical work that's been done that shows that most of the Haggadah that we know was composed by post-destruction rabbis. And some people see it as one of the ways of coping with the destruction.
Yeah, so there is a lot of material. I think, if I remember correctly, that I think it's Professor Golinkin has an academic Haggadah where
he does
it.
More than one.
Of the Shechter, right.
There's a lot of
I've seen pieces of it, which is pretty good, but I haven't read the whole thing.
Not on this point, but I should have jumped in earlier. There's just on the issue of which custom, which minhag trumps what, the family or the place. So there's a fellow in shul here in this congregation. So we do not put on tefillin during Chol HaMoed, but it was his father's custom, so he honors his father by wearing his tefillin on Chol HaMoed.
Right, and this is one of the cases that often has creates a lot of tension. Not so much in actually North America, but in Israel, if you put on tefillin al chalamoid, they will yell at you. In any shul, it is a national. They will yell at you. You cannot. They will physically throw you out because no one in the country does it. There's one shul in Yerushalayim of German descent that does it. That's it. Ashkenazim, Sephardim, everybody. That is the custom. Yeah, in North America, we're much more relaxed about it. But in Israel, they're not relaxed about this one for some reason. Okay, so what the father of Maimonides here introduces is that maybe the paradigmatic type of custom is not local custom, it's really national customs. Local customs are like a mitigated expression of national custom, but the real customs are national customs, which are clearly going to have a much more powerful pull legally than local customs, right? The more ubiquitous something is in general, the more we assume that it is binding. Okay, so far we have this discussion. We see that local customs and national customs are definitely binding. Family customs might be. In 11:12, I just briefly summarize here that a question that emerges from this is as follows. We haven't really addressed, and I'll just say it quickly, well, why would your father's customs be binding? So there are different explanations, but the standard understanding amongst authorities is because it's a type of a vow. Or we know we're allowed to accept vows, so if you accept to do a certain practice which has religious value, so you've accepted a type of a vow. And either you've accepted a personal vow or your community has accepted a vow, it takes on the status of a vow. How that happens without you actually explicitly making a vow is an interesting question, but that's the assumption.
Don't vows have a time?
Sometimes, and sometimes they don't. Right? Sometimes you take a vow forever. It's not always a good idea, right? Vows are not a good idea in general. They tend to lead to disasters. I remember one of my teachers once got a call from a woman who said, I made a vow and I don't remember what it was. What do I do? Right? Vows are a bad idea. They could really... But the question then emerges, okay, well, if it's based on a vow, so can you nullify it? Even if you say that you are bound by your family custom, well, what if you choose to change it? So you can't... If you think, like Rabbi Attar and Rabbi... Eliashiv, so then you think that you can't just flippantly not follow the custom. But can you say, okay, look, I'm not going to be flippant about it, but I can't keep this custom, or I don't want to. Can I formally nullify it, or is it for some reason more powerful than a regular vow? So that's a dispute. In 11, I just summarize it. The Chatam Sofer, Moshe Sofer, living in the 19th century in Hungary, Hungary, says that the fathers could, because they accepted it. But once your father did it and it passed to the second generation, you can't. And many of the later commentaries explain, because normally you can nullify a vow because you made it. So you can undo it. But the children didn't make it, so they can't undo it. So ironically, they're more stuck than their fathers who actively chose to take it. The Pri Chadash, Rabbi Chizkiah de Silva, living in... Did I put his actual thing here later on? I think I did. I did on the next page. I don't know why I put it later. He lived in Italy and Israel in the 17th century. He says that the fathers can, and obviously the kids can. The fathers accepted it, and the kids, they were pushed into it. So even if you think it's binding, they can get out of it. They might have to go through the formality of undoing it, but they can get out of it. In 12, I just note, and this is what I mentioned before, that what types of customs are we talking about? So in 12, I mentioned a type of custom we didn't look into yet, is sometimes you have customs to do something new, right? Like, let's say the Seder, okay? There's no dispute about whether or not you should do the Seder the way we do it. There just was sort of a blank slate, and we slowly filled it with customs, and they're religiously meaningful, so they become binding. What if there's a dispute about an actual law? Wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Okay, good example. And the custom in Israel is to not wear it. The custom in certain Sephardi lands was to not wear it. Ashkenazim, they were split depending on where you lived. What if you have a custom not to do something new, but to accept a certain legal position? Is that stronger or weaker than a custom to accept a new practice? What do you think? Right, if we have...
Say it again and slower.
So slower, right?
What's the question?
The question is as follows. Let's say your custom is not to create a new practice like the Seder. It's to accept a certain legal position. We do or we don't wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. is that custom stronger than the custom of the Seder or weaker than the custom of the Seder, let's say? What do you think? Stronger or weaker?
Well, it must be weaker because weaker. There's an another...
So on the one hand, you could say it's weaker because there's a dispute, right? No one is accepting a new thing. They're taking sides in a dispute, and the other position still exists. So you could say, we are accustomed to do this, and the person in the back of the room will say, well, my rabbi says not that way. So you could say it's weaker, or you could say it's stronger. Why? Because it's accustomed to accept a legal position. We've now crossed from custom to law. So one could say that maybe this is stronger because the Seder is very nice, but it's only a custom. Its source is derived from custom. The custom to accept a certain legal position might have the status not of custom, but of law. So that's the dispute in 12. So the Pri Chadash, or De Silva, quotes the Maharash Dam in... I just summarize it because it's long, and he says that only customs to forbid things that are permitted are considered vows and can be nullified. A custom to follow a stringent position in rabbinic dispute cannot, as one is choosing to treat it as forbidden. He says it is stronger because when you cross that threshold from custom to law and you mix those two very potent factors of Jewish life, magically it becomes eternal. There is no way out. So if you... your father's custom or your family custom or your local custom was to accept a certain stringent position of law, you can never get out of it because you've crossed the threshold from custom and law and now you are stuck.
Every stringent position amounts to a law?
No, in a dispute, right? He said in a legal position. If you specifically, that case, he says not if you just accept a stringency. If you accept a stringent position in a legal dispute, you cross from custom into law, it takes the status of law and cannot be nullified. The Pri Chadash himself, Rav De Silva, says no. This is only if you don't have a rabbi. If they have an established scholar, he can rule leniently, for they only became accustomed like this based on that authority, forbade because they thought the law was like him. But since their rabbi has proved to contradict that authority, they're only obligated to follow the judge in their days. The first custom based on that authority is a mistaken custom. It's not actually mistaken, but the point is, if you followed custom, you said, I'm going to wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed because my rabbi said wear tefillin, and then the next rabbi says, well, I think you shouldn't. You didn't have some custom to follow the first rabbi. He was your rabbi at that time, so you followed it. And now he doesn't want that to happen to Shul. Okay, so you won't do it. Law cannot be subject to the same rules as custom because it works based on legal mechanisms. Law isn't based on custom. Law is based on proof. Yeah. Right? And therefore, he argues, no, it's weaker, like Michael said. And I have only written that mistaken custom can be omitted without nullification. So the Maharash Dam and the Pri Chadash take opposite positions. The Maharash Dam says when you mix custom and law, it becomes super powerful. And the Pri Chadash says you can't mix custom and law. Customs are customs and law is law. Okay. Yeah, okay. So now, there's another type of minhag, which we haven't talked, well, which we mentioned, which is the minhag of, let's say, Ashkenaz and Sfarad, things like that. The ethnic group. Okay, so is that binding? So again, this is a modern question, because traditionally, why did you keep minhag Ashkenaz? Because you lived in Ashkenaz. You lived in Germany, you lived in France, you lived in Europe. Why did you keep minhag Sfarad? Because you lived in Spain, or you lived in North Africa, or you lived in Yemen. And yes, I know that there's not actually Ashkenazim and Sephardim, but I'm just colloquially using it. That's not the point. Okay. What if I'm a quote-unquote Ashkenazi living in Canada? Am I bound to Ashkenazi customs, like kitniot on Pesach? Can I eat kitniot? Yes, no. So, that is not that new of a question, but it's a pretty new question. As things go, it's about 500 years old. It was first asked by the Masa Melech, who is Rabbi Yosef ibn Ezra living in Italy. It's quoted here in the Pri Chadash again in 13. And, he's writing post the Spanish expulsion. So he says as follows. Members of a city that are exiled and establish their residence in another place, which has different leniencies and stringencies from those that they are accustomed to. How should the exiled one act? Right? This is the precursor to the Ashkenazi Sephardi question. Right? You, as a community, move. It's no longer an individual who moves. Right? If an Ashkenazi 600 years ago, moved into a Sephardi land, he became a Sephardi. But let's say your whole community picks up and moves, and now you have a Sephardi enclave in an Ashkenaz city. Or in Canada, you have an Ashkenaz shul and a Sephardi shul. So then, do ethnic customs have force? Can you recreate North Africa in Toronto? Yes or no? So he writes, any new city, if it is known where people came from, the custom will follow the place they came from. The reason is that it's a new city. However, if they came to a city that has a quorum, even if those who come are more numerous, they are like individuals and must follow the stringencies of the place they came to, and the stringencies from the place they came from have been removed. So he says as follows, it depends. Let's say you move into a vacuum. You move into a country with no Jews at all. So then he says, yes, you bring your customs with you. You have now recreated Little Italy, right? Little Spain in wherever you want, okay? You know, it's the new world in America. You move into the Wild West and you set up shop, and with your Jews from, if we want to be historically accurate, Portugal or Spain, right? Those were the earlier Jews in the States. So you've recreated Portugal in the States. Hence the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue in New York. That's what it is. It's a right? It's very, very, very old shul, several hundred years old, bringing in the community from Portugal into New York. But he said, but let's say there was a community there. And he says, not a big community. I don't care if there's 10 people there. If there's a minyan in the city you come to, I don't care if you bring 10,000 people. You are now moving into their territory. And therefore, you can't insist that the New Yorkers become Portuguese. I don't care if you outnumber them 1,000 times. It doesn't matter. You can only recreate Portugal if there's a vacuum. If there's not a vacuum, even a tiny little community, so then ethnic custom actually isn't binding, because we now go back to our question before. The most basic type of custom in Jewish law, as we saw, was the place. So sure, he's willing to say that if you move into a new place with no custom, you could recreate a mini Spain, a mini Portugal. But if there is a custom there, you can't impose ethnic customs on top of local custom. That doesn't work. And that's the position of the Pri Chadash. Yeah.
Is the small existing community permitted to grant permission to the new group?
Possibly, right? They could say, you know what, and that's sort of like what happened at some point in Amsterdam, right? That Amsterdam had a community and many, many people from Portugal and Spain moved there, and eventually the community became much more Sephardi, right? And including the Ashkenazi elements accepted many of the Sephardi customs. So possibly, but they can't force them. And if they say, look, this is our city, you're coming into it and we're happy to bring you in, so then they become members of that city.
But they can maintain their own customs still.
No.
They have to maintain those customs.
They would.
So if the Portuguese come to New York, and the New Yorkers had been there first, the Ashkenazim, let's say, had been there first, and if the Ashkenazim's minhag was not to eat kibbutz, when the Portuguese show up, they got to give up all their kibbutz.
Correct. Exactly. And that's what the Pri Chadash said. Now, the Knesset HaGdola, citing Maharit, also quoted the Pri Chadash, he puts a caveat on this, and he says, no, the stringencies of the place they left are not removed until they establish themselves in a city that has a new lenient custom, but not a city that has no established custom. He says, it's not just about people being there. They need to have a custom that is contrary to yours to uproot it. If you move and there happen to be Jews, but they don't have a custom, then you do carry your customs with you. He even thinks you have to, because you need a new custom to replace your old one. So this question, the now what we call minhag adadit, the minhag of the ethnic group, if you look at the traditional sources, it actually seems like it is not binding. But we traditionally treat it as binding. And this is where, in informal philosophical language, I would say, I would profess epistemic humility. In normal English, that would mean, I'm not sure why we do this. Another rabbi contacted me who's writing a paper on it and said, I appreciated the fact that you admit that you don't know. And I will leave it as such, that the traditional sources actually point to the fact that you can't recreate a custom in a new place. It's not clear why we consider ethnic customs binding. The key might be this Maharit over here, because in Canada, let's say, in Toronto, there isn't a custom, there are many customs. And if you think that ethnic customs are binding until there's a new custom to replace them, then if you move into a multicultural society like North America or Israel, so then ethnic customs would be binding. So many people do claim, and again, this is possible, I'm just not sure that it's true, that the reason that we consider ethnic customs binding is because of this Maharit in 14, that the only way to uproot ethnic customs is to move into a place that has a set custom. But if you move into a place with many different customs, then each person is continuously bound by their original custom. So now...
That had to have applied here, sir, because we have a large, thriving Sephardi community that came to the greater Toronto.
Correct. And in Toronto, you have Ashkenazim, you have Sephardim, you have everything, you have Hasidim, you have... What?
First, we had the Ashkenazim here, and they were the Minyan, they were the quorum. And then it was only once we got all those Montrealers that came in with their Sephardi.
So I'm not going to. I don't know what the history is exactly. I know the states better than I do know Canada's.
It's a wonderful thing. It's every
correct. And part of it is what they point to is that the fact that we are sort of we embrace multiculturalism may be what makes multiculturalism binding, right? Ironically, right? The fact that we are so opposed to binding other people to our customs is what makes it that their customs remain binding. That's essentially what the Maharit says, right? That if there, no one tries to impose a custom, but according to Pri Chadash, this would not be true. Right? According to Pri Chadash, ethnic customs would not be binding. According to Maharit, they might be. Okay, so now we've outlined...
I got a Toronto custom for you.
Yeah.
I actually have one.
Tim Hortons.
From the Americas?
No, from here. But we used to use corn oil. Corn oil used to be sold as kosher to Pesach. And I was in a Pesach workshop, let's say within the past 5 years, and the rabbi said, anybody here remember using corn oil? And the older one said, yes. So I grew up, corn oil was permitted. And peanut oil too, in my childhood and in my young adulthood. Okay, so now corn oil is considered forbidden. Am I, who grew up with corn oil for 30 years, permitted to use it?
So we have a rule in the Kollel, which is we ask your local rabbi, is our answer to all actual halachic questions. So I'm going to leave that to other people to answer. Okay. Okay, so now what we've outlined is national customs, which are binding, local customs, which are binding, and we've noted that ethnic customs may or may not be. It's unclear. Our tradition seems to be to treat it as binding. And then family customs, which, again, we take seriously, but there's a big dispute as to whether they are, in fact, binding. Okay. In 15, I'm going to summarize because I want to get to some of the sources later. 15...
You don't have that long left.
I know, and that's why I'm jumping here. I have 8 minutes, according to my clock here.
Yeah,
so in 15, the Rajba, Rav Shimon ben Aderet, writing in the 13th century... just introduces what becomes very important in halacha later, that there were people who began to accept, and this comes back to our customs of accepting certain halachic positions, that Sfaradim would rule like Maimonides, right? And Ashkenazim would rule like whoever. So he argues that that in fact is legitimate. He argues that the way that works is just like you can be bound to your local shul rabbi, you can choose... A community can choose to make Maimonides, quote-unquote, their shul rabbi. So another reason that ethnic custom may be binding is not because of the mechanism of custom, but of this mechanism, what we call the authority of the local rabbi. And once the Rajba introduces this possibility that you can pick, and this comes to Nancy's point, an ideological, you know... an ideological custom rather than a local custom, right? You can pick, I am part of Maimonides' community even though he died hundreds of years ago. That opens another reason why it might be that we consider ethnic customs binding, not because of custom, but because we've, so to speak, created a society in which we accept the historical authorities of our community as being our ideological community, so to speak. In an ideological multicultural world, we identify, right? Maybe identify is the better word. We identify with a certain school, and that can be binding based on the same authority that we give to local rabbis. So that's another possibility. Now, one of the questions that will come up in this is what happens when there's a conflict. So in 16, Rav Moshe Feinstein says something reasonable. He says, well, sometimes there's a conflict. We have another value in Judaism in addition to custom, which is not having fights and not having a lot of people doing different things that will cause stress. So he says, let's say you're in yeshiva, you're out, you have a student, he's in school. The school has one custom and his father has a different custom. So he says the very common sense thing, which is, do what your father does at home and do what the school does at school, right? You have to, when you're dealing with customs, you got to be smart about it. Reb Rabinovich, who used to be the rabbi of Clanton Park, but now is a Rosh Hashiva in Israel, in 17, says beyond the technical halachic question, the reason he encourages people to follow their family minhagim, even if they might not be technically binding, is because he says like this in 17. He says, with all the customs like this, a person must take into account his family and friends, not to sit amongst the standers or stand among the sitters. For this seems arrogant and leads to strife and gossip. Because of the emotional element in this issue, I advise all who ask me to do as their fathers do, so as not to embarrass their fathers, God forbid, even if their fathers forgive it, and the honors of fathers is great. And he says, right, in addition to the halachic, the legal reason why one might hold on to a custom, there's also the emotional element where he says not everything can be boiled down to a legal question. So now if we, right, just reorganize here. So we have binding national customs, binding local customs, possibly binding, possibly not binding ethnic customs, possibly binding, possibly not binding family customs. Then we have two other points, which is even those which are not binding, there's an emotional reason to follow custom. And Rav Moshe Feinstein's point that even that value should recognize other values, such as when it will cause strife, and you have to balance those two values together. So now, just quickly, now why is it, though? We haven't explained that custom is so important. We've just proven that it is, but why is it? So, 18, the Talmud says in one place, Hillel said, I heard this law and forgot it. Rather, leave Israel. If they are not prophets, they are children of prophets. So some people say, why is it? Because God speaks through the actions of the Jewish people. Their very action is a form of prophecy. And the fact that people do it and have done it for hundreds of years means that God is speaking through them, and it's a form of prophecy. So one reason why it might be binding is because it's a way of God speaking in this world. His providence makes it that we do the right thing. Rabbi Soloveitchik in 19 has a nice formulation. He says as follows, this is the practical tradition based on the customs of Israel and keeping of the commandments. Based on the verse, ask your fathers and they will tell your elders and they shall say it to you. Proofs and logic cannot prove anything about the tradition of ask your fathers and they will tell you. There the logic does not decide, but the tradition itself. This is how our fathers acted, were seen, and this is how the children must act. He says the answer is, why is it binding? Because it is, right? We do it because our parents do it, and what gives it its force is that we do it, right? That gives it the force. It may also be related to the providence thing in 18, and in another formulation that I bracket here, he says that sometimes history proves the truth or falsehood of certain positions, so it is a form of prophecy, but at some level it's also that it's binding because it's binding. The Maimonides in 20 actually says that it may derived from the same verse that gives rabbis their power, the Talmudic rabbis their power to begin with. The verse, do not stray from what they tell you right or left. Sometimes that applies to law, but he thinks that it also binds us to custom. And that same force that binds us to law binds us to custom as well. Okay, in the last 3 minutes, I just want to get back to the emotional element. As we noted, right, all of this is why custom might be binding. But as Reb Rabinovich said, the reason that we keep to custom is not only because it's binding, but because emotionally it's meaningful and it fills in that part, that large part of life that can't be fit into the skeleton of law. So you seem to have this in 21. The Talmud says that Rabbi Judah, the son of Rabbi Shmuel bar Shelat, said in the name of Rav, the guest may not eat anything until the one who breaks bread is tasted. Rav Safra sat and stated the statement was may not taste. So what difference does it make? Right? Well, who cares how he said it? So it says, it teaches that one must repeat the exact words of his teacher. There is no legal difference between those two formulations, but there's a value to doing what your teachers did, what your parents did, because there's a value to doing it. Because there's more to life than law. And this comes back to Diane's point at the end in 22. Right? Rabbi Soloveitchik, in his eulogy for his sister-in-law, no, for however he was related to the Rebbetzin of Talna, it was his son-in-law's, okay, whatever it is, his No, his mechutanim, right? His mechutanim. It's his in-laws. His in-law, the Rebbetzin of Talna, in his eulogy, he said, "What is Torat Imecha? Right? Why is Mina called the Torah of your mother? What kind of Torah does the mother pass on?" He says, "Permit me to draw upon my own experiences. I used to watch her arranging the house in honor of a holiday. I used to see her recite prayers. I used to watch her recite the Sidra every Friday night, and I still remember the nostalgic tune. I learned from her very much. Most of all," he's talking about his mother, right? But it's in the middle of a eulogy. He writes, "Most of all, I learned that Judaism expresses itself not only in a formal compliance with the laws, but also in a living experience. She taught me that there is a flavor, a scent, and a warmth to mitzvot. I learned from her the most important thing in life, to feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hand resting upon my frail shoulders. Without her teachings, which quite often were transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive. The laws of Shabbat, for instance, were passed on to me by my father. They are part of a Musar Avicha. The Shabbat as a living entity, as a queen, was revealed to me by my mother. It is part of Torat Imecha. The fathers knew much about the Shabbat. The mothers lived the Shabbat, experienced her presence, and perceived her beauty and splendor. The fathers taught generations how to observe the Shabbat. Mothers taught generations how to greet the Shabbat and how to enjoy her 24-hour presence." And Rabbi Salvechik gives voice to this, and he says the reason that this last level of custom is so powerful, and he thinks that this, in many levels, even why custom is binding, even on the legal level, is because law is about more than law. Life is about more than law. And the spirit, the scent, the warmth of Jewish experience, feeling God's presence, often comes from that which can't be quantified and concretized into law. It's specifically from that, which is what we saw from Philo, the living tradition that lives within us of custom. In 23, you can read it yourself as a nice description from his son of the power of custom on his experience on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. You can read it inside in 23. So like I said, what we've done is we've just sort of done a snapshot of why custom is important, why it's binding, why it's important even when it's not binding. And as we said, the Seder is one of those times where custom is so important and so rich. And once we've sort of given, we've articulated why it is that intuition we have that custom is so important, why that is true and based in Jewish sources, the next two times we'll examine some of the actual customs of the Seder to enrich our Seder experience.